You are listening to Are We There Yet?, the podcast about the intersection of sustainability, technology, and communication. I'm Jamie Hardy.
And I'm Sonia Ernst.
Please join us today as we welcome Dr. Rena Bliss. Dr. Rena Bliss is an associate professor of sociology at Rutgers University. Her work spans epigenetics, sociogenomics, and the importance of creativity in expressing our human intelligence. An accomplished public speaker and author, her books include Rethinking Intelligence, A Radical New Understanding of Our Human Potential, Race Decoded, The Genomic Fight for Social Justice, and Social by Nature, The Promise and Peril of Sociogenomics. She's currently working on a new book on race and genomics due out next spring. We've invited her here to talk with us today about how our environment shapes our intelligence and what that means in a fast-moving world increasingly colored by AI. Welcome, Rena.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. So, Rena, you did some extensive research in genetics and intelligence. I'm very curious to hear, what is your definition of being smart?
I'm going to actually shift my answer towards my definition of intelligence, because I think it's really critical to start there, especially when we're thinking about artificial intelligence. We have to kind of understand what is human intelligence, and then we can talk about what's good human intelligence, like smartness. So the first thing I want to say is that I define human intelligence as learning from our environments. It's a process that we're always engaged in. And, you know, we have a lot of boxes that we put people into. We say, this person's neurotypical, this person's neurodivergent. Actually, we're all just different from each other. And we're also similar in one way, which is that no matter what our brains are doing, we are learning from our environments. That's the basic kind of thing that we've evolved to do as human beings. And so it's a very creative process that we're always engaged in. Now, when people say, this is a smart person, this is a dumb person, this person is a high achiever, this person is low performing, all of these boxes and things, they're really just constructs that we've created. And I believe that it's a mistake. It's a big mistake that we've made. We base that off of different academic benchmarks usually and standardized test scores. I write a lot about that in my book, Rethinking Intelligence. But, you know, we've developed these intelligence tests, IQ tests, all of these different academic benchmarks, and we've kind of narrowed our understanding of intelligence, human intelligence, to the point where we've eliminated the notion of creativity from that. And so I'm trying to bring that back into our conversation and into our discourse so that we can focus more on that creative process that we are always engaging in. A person who is labeled as neurodivergent, a person who is labeled as autistic, for example, that person is also learning from their environment, right? So it's like, this is what I want us to kind of focus on. And when we understand that basic definition and how creative that process is and how much we're doing that our whole entire lives, whether we're aware of it or not, then we can start to see the differences in ourselves from robots, from AI, from chatbots, from androids, humanistic robots.
What you're saying is that our composition as a person, my composition as a person, makes me capable of certain things that others are not capable of. Let's call that a superpower for a second. I have a superpower that when we look at our society, we reward certain behavior, certain knowledge, certain actions. If my superpower is outside of these norms, then I am being labeled as not appropriate, not acceptable, not good enough. A mentor of mine used to say, if we measure a fish based on how they climb the tree, the fish will always fail. Is this what you're saying?
Yes. And I think that in addition to us getting it wrong, so often in the places that we exist in, from a sociologist's perspective, we might call it the institutions of our society. From a layperson's, you know, conversational standpoint, we might use the terms like the places like our schools, our workplaces, our home environment, all of these places that we find ourselves throughout the day, those places squash the creativity. So in addition to us labeling people in harmful ways, because we believe so strongly in those labels and those binaries and dichotomies, we end up squashing the creativity. And we miss out on how much creativity we all have to share. Anyone who will listen, I want to say this to you. We need to seize all the learning moments in our day. Seize them. I'm not saying that we learn from morning till night, that we, you know, don't take breaks. Actually, we need to take breaks. That's part of the learning process, is to rest. But when we can, we need to seize that learning moment. If you are being labeled as a person who is subpar, and then you're being, in the case of youth, put into these academic environments that are not stimulating and that are just like designed to babysit you, basically, then what happens is you end up not living out your true potential. And the same can be said for adults when they're in the workplace. There are so many workers who are not living out their own potential. And that becomes a problem for management, of course, because, you know, you've got people who are just a poor fit in a certain environment and they're not living out their potential and no one knows how to fix this problem. And the question becomes like, do we replace people with bots? Of course, you know, it's like, why is everybody talking about that? Well, it's like, you know, there's a lot of undereducated and underperforming vis-a-vis their potential people out there.
I hear you say several things as you're talking about this. Then one of those is the environment where we decide to be active, where we have a job, where we have a responsibility. We often subconsciously choose the environment that fits our superpower best, our skill set best. Sometimes either we don't understand what the environment really expects of us. Sometimes we don't assess our own capabilities well. And in these cases, we're placed in an environment where we not necessarily perform well naturally. Being an executive coach, I see that often as a reason for burnout. And you mentioned environment where children, schools are created in a specific way so that children struggle because they cannot be creative. That's the one thing that I heard you say. The other thing that I found very interesting is one of our previous guests is a neuroscientist. One of the things that she spoke about is that as humans, we have this capability. When someone tells us we do a great job and repeatedly tells us you do a great job, you do a great job, I start believing in myself and assessing myself as I'm doing a great job. Confidence rises, even though I not necessarily do a great job, but I'm being rewarded for expectations in a specific environment. What do you think about that?
That's another point that I make in my book, and also, you know, as I do more research into all of the fallout from AI and from other technologies and other forms of genetic science and all of this, all of the kind of mistaken notions that we're getting that are bubbling up in this moment, is that we are inherently neuroplastic. Our brains, they are growing, developing. We put our attention onto something and our brains kind of shapeshift to help us, to enable us to really learn that thing. But this is a very important point. Learning and being intelligent and using your intelligence is an emotional process as well. And so when we are learning something and somebody is telling us, especially if we're a child, someone's telling us something positive, like, oh, let me reinforce that about you. That's good behavior, good job. Or this is you excelling and you're better than other people and all of these kind of messages that play on our emotions, then we will, of course, focus on that activity more, and then we'll continue to shut out other activities, other learning opportunities. And I'm not saying that it's the best thing to just spread yourself thin and not go deep in things, but if the going deep is something that comes from your own curiosity, that's a positive thing. If the going deep is something that comes out of some kind of societal reinforcement because that is considered good behavior, then that's people pleasing. And I'm a professor, so I have students who are about, 18 to 22 years old, sometimes 17, sometimes a little bit older. But, that's my kind of range of my students. And then I have kids. I'm a mom. I've got three small children. So, the very early end of the spectrum. And then, you see all of these adults and you think, what were they like when they were kids, right? They are so on top of the world, doing the best, so successful, but the emotional thing is off. And I'm not saying that as a blanket judgment or anything like that. I'm just saying that we get to that point because oftentimes when you're high achieving and you've been told you're just so smart and you're so good at this and you're, got all the right test scores and you got the GPA and then you went on and you outperformed everybody in your college and grad school and you're a leader. And then all of a sudden you're like, but do I really like what I'm doing? And why am I here? Instead of just saying, okay, we can stimulate your curiosity, you will learn, knowing that kids will learn. I know that these students can get it. They're going to get it. Assuming that and then empowering them through their own curiosity and not putting my own values on top of them, rather telling them it's time for you to own your own curiosity and seize that learning moment. Here's the material that you want to know from me. Now let's talk about it. Let's get into it. These are the kinds of things that we have to think about. I think the emotional piece of learning is something that we don't really talk about as much in common cultural conversations and narratives and discourse.
In your book, when you're talking in Rethinking Intelligence, when you're talking about neuroplasticity in the workplace, say, your advice to leaders is to make sure that people know that their current position is temporary and to cultivate a growth mindset. And within this, I see the need for intrinsic motivation versus an extrinsic motivation of you're doing a great job, but someone to really recognize on their own that they're doing a good job and define for themselves what is a good job. And so as someone who, is shaping the way we think about this and teaching people, and you ultimately have to grade people, how do you foster intrinsic motivation when it's really something that we kind of have to come to on our own?
Well, I start by telling my students that we're here to have conversations. We're not here for me to tell you how smart you are. So I let them know that I already believe in them and that I want to learn from them as well. So I ask them to tell me about their own experiences and their knowledge of the world around them. And every time that I teach a new module or a new topic, I ask them first, what do you know about this already? That lets them know that we're going to learn a little bit beyond what you thought you knew about it, but we're going to start with what you already know. So I let them know that they are experts too. So I said that my students are between the ages roughly of 18 to 22, but really I have grad students, I have postdocs, I work with all ages, and I've had students who are even older than my parents. I've had the whole gamut. To me, I always see these individuals as my future colleagues. They will be my future colleagues, especially my grad students. They literally will get a job at the end of their 5 or 6 years, and then they're going to be my colleague. These are the future experts of our world. And I tell them that in the first day of class, I always say, you are the future experts. This class is for you to get more information. And I also posit it as information. And it's a little slice of information that they can use, hopefully, because they chose to come to this class. I didn't choose it for them. There's no one forcing their hand in what they take. And so they come and they want to know about this topic.
Rena, it sounds like including giving them information and sharing your expertise, you're also teaching them awareness in some ways and how to be aware not only of themselves and their own capabilities, but their environment, other people in the environment, the technology in their environment, the physical environment that they're in. Would you say that mindfulness also comes into this and how exactly mindfulness and awareness sort of correlate with intelligence, and to take it a next step further, how AI might have those or not have those, or help us have them.
Yes, definitely. So mindfulness, I give these three strategies that I offer. In my book, Rethinking Intelligence, I talk a lot about genetics because that is really my wheelhouse. When I talk about intelligence, I'm coming at it from the perspective of intelligence genetic science and the newest avenues of that research. So when I come to the kind of the middle of the book, I start to talk about strategies that we could use that are what I call low tech. And basically, they're not risky, crazy things like editing our genomes, which is really an option for people if they want to. You can't do that in the US, but you can definitely do some medical tourism and find your way into a lab that will do that for you. It's not that simple, but basically that will increasingly be an option for us. And so I say, let's do things like instill a growth mindset. Also, work on mindfulness, establish a mindfulness practice, or at least establish a kind of mindfulness orientation in our daily lives. The third one is a kind of connected reciprocal form of learning, a collaborative form of learning in our workplaces and in our schools and all of that. But to focus on the mindfulness question and the piece of it, yes, we need to teach our workers, our children, our people that we coexist with, how to seize that learning moment through being aware of it, through being really tuned into these opportunities in our environments. That's something that people can do for themselves as they create their own, like maybe breathing, meditation, you know, there are different kind of home strategies in a way. But as leaders and managers, we actually have to make space for that. We have to make it a part of the culture so that we're not just saying, okay, you go home and do this and come back to me all, you know, mindfulled out, right? No, we have to actually make either physical space, like there's a room where someone can go, or also just temporal space, like, you know, these are the times when you can take care of yourself and when you can go into your own mind and like center yourself. So we have to kind of institutionalize it, really. That is something that does differentiate us from AI, in that we are learning from our environments in a very kind of fluid, flexible, and complicated, complex way. There is the emotional component to our learning. AI learns from a data set, and it is a fixed data set. And even though it has way more data points than we can access in a given moment, we actually have, from our memories and from all of the things that we have learned, we have a lot of data in our minds as well. But the AI thing isn't an emotional process. AI is so useful and helpful in terms of getting a lot of data and processing it in a quick amount of time in a way that a human brain can't, of course, but it's not creative, it's not emotional, and we can try to tell it to be emotional and be creative, but it's only going to do that as well as we tell it to. So in a sense, like, we're always going to be the creative and emotional force in the whole thing. Knowing that for us, we are starting with our innate curiosity and our innate passion to know more and to improve our environments. That's another piece of it that I haven't really talked about yet with you, is that the whole reason why we've evolved our brains in the way that we have is to improve our environments, to be able to improve our lives. It's not just to like be stagnant. We actually are always trying to make something a little bit better. Economists will call this rational choice theory. I'm not all about that. I think that it's much more social, it's much more communal, it's much more altruistic, it's much more collaborative and reciprocal, as I was mentioning earlier. Collectively, we want to improve things so that we can all have a better life. And again, no matter how typical or divergent you appear to be, you are part of that process of making things just a little bit better.
So considering that aspect that we are social beings, that we need to be together and we thrive when we collaborate, how do you see artificial intelligence influence the way we collaborate? And with that, I mean not only how we learn in schools, how we interact with each other in our private lives, personal lives, but also corporate world. How will artificial intelligence change our interactions?
It can go in a few different ways. And I'll just focus on kind of my hopeful best outcome and then the kind of worst outcome, okay? Because we have yet to see where it's going. We need to see how we jump on top of all of the ethical issues. I feel like every single day, if not every single week, there are new strides and advances in companies taking responsibility for the ethical side of things. When we see deep fakes coming out, when we see child pornography deep fakes. One of the things I talked about with my class just the other day is like kids can buy drugs on Instagram, on Snap. So when we see children ODing from purchasing drugs online and then tech companies coming together and saying like, you know, we can't let this go on, right? So when we see the companies doing this and then the EU creating, you know, policy around it, the US having an act, you know, and marching towards creating policy, I think that that shows that things aren't going to be as crazy terrible as they could be, but I'm still going to go through these two scenarios. So one is that we integrate AI into our systems in a limited form, and we say like these are the things that are that we can use AI for that aren't going to harm a bunch of people. First thing is, as a parent, watermarks on everything that's AI generated. I don't care what you're talking about. Everybody should know that we're dealing with AI produced material. Then also, AI is already integrated into the back end of most of our companies and most of the financial, you know, side of things, the HR side of things, right? So in the university where I teach, AI is in our all of the back end systems, the things that we don't really like as the creatives, like we don't need to know that part of it, right? So that's already happened in a sense. And then we have to decide like, okay, if we're going to also have individual employees and managers and all of that using AI beyond its AI is like doing payroll or something like that. Now we have to say, what are the limitations of that? In my perfect world, we would use AI to cut time for knowledge-based inquiries. So that means if you're doing research, if you need to know information about the history of the institution, or you want to know some market information, consumer insights, all of that kind of stuff, and you want to use AI to just do that bit of research, then make sure that there are humans on the other end of it, fact-checking, making sure there aren't just a bunch of hallucinations and bad information. That would be, for me, a good use of AI. Using it to hire, just straight up decide who is going to be in the organization, to fire people, all of that stuff, I think that's a bad use of AI. But we could go into that world. That would be the bad case scenario for me. Using it to replace humans, very bad idea, because then what are we going to have? Just like a manager with like a bunch of bots? I think that that is, in some senses, I think that there are people who are creating, developing AI technologies that think that agents can and should replace humans. And I think that that's a bad idea, given that somebody needs to fact check AI. It's not like you're going to get perfect information. Best case scenario, we use it for limited knowledge-based inquiries, and then we don't see it as like doing the creative part of all of the job that we need to do, freeing us up to do more of that creative work, to do more learning. I use AI in my research just as a starting point. I just want to know a history of this policy. Then I have to have a human assistant, research assistant, fact check that. That becomes the jump off for the human being. That would be the best case scenario. Something that it would empower them to do more creative thinking. The worst case scenario is that we just replace all of the workers, including teachers, including professors, including doctors, including therapists, you name it, with bots. And that is also something that some AI companies do envision us doing at some point to like solve our economic problems, sometimes crushing economic problems. In education, we're constantly underfunded. We're always having trouble with, you know, staffing, right? So it's like, just put a bot in there, just solve it with a bot. And because, especially in the realm of education, because it is an emotional process, and because brains are forming and that neuroplasticity is at its all-time high, this is super dangerous.
What I hear you say is that a way for us to coexist with artificial intelligence is we humans need to focus on things that make us human, meaning emotion, feelings, and creativity.
Exactly.
And in some ways, even just existing is a creative act, and you don't have to produce to be creative. And AI can sort of possibly help us exist in a more exalted way without feeling the need to be a part of this production cycle that we're in.
Exactly. If you talk to almost any person who is out there in the workforce, no matter what area they work in, what industry, what space, you know, they're overwhelmed. Throw being a parent into the mix, or a grandparent, or just a caregiver of some kind, you know, even like a fur parent, you know, it's like no matter what, you're overwhelmed. It's like too much, right? So yes, take some of the not so creative aspect of your knowledge pursuits off of your desk, basically, or off of your list of things to do with AI, sure, but only so that you can have more time to do mindfulness practice, to tap into the learning opportunities in your environment, and to pursue things that you are truly curious about. If we had it so that we were empowering our workers, and of course, even as leaders, if we are making sure that we are giving ourselves that time to be creative and think really with curiosity, like that of a child, what's interesting to me about this thing that I'm solving? I think that we will be a lot happier and we will be a lot more balanced. We'll show up better for the people in our lives that we need to show up for. So I do think that there are some really great benefits. There are also certain kinds of problems that we will want AI to solve. In my realm of expertise around genetics and genomics, we can benefit from AI telling us more about the structures of proteins and those pathways. And that's kind of like the healthy use of AI, is just having it take a data set that we have and go in there and just tell us what are the patterns. Tumor genome mapping, that kind of thing. That's really helpful. If we ask a computer to do it, a human is not going to do that same job in the same amount of time. But in terms of knowing what's important about the work that we're doing, knowing what people actually want and what is healthy for people, you know, when we're thinking about, you know, you said the corporate world, a lot of what we need to know is how to be in touch with our consumers, our person, our customer, and knowing like what is a healthy and positive way to engage that person. That kind of thing requires a human understanding.
When you think of anxiety that we're all experiencing around changes that artificial intelligence is bringing, how can we move away from that anxiety and focus on growth mindset?
Hopefully, knowing how our brains work and knowing that we can benefit from being aware of the learning that we're doing, because we're often doing it without being aware of it. So learning that we can kind of capitalize on that process that's already running in the background, hopefully that will help people to value the human form of intelligence more. And that will allow them to make these distinctions that I'm making that I'm trying to, you know, put out there into the world. And that will help them understand that you can't replace or create something artificial that is going to be as good as the human form of intelligence. And hopefully that will help people to understand that we don't need to move into a world where we just replace everybody, replace the workforce, replace the leaders, the managers, and all of that. There are definitely going to be a lot of jobs that won't exist. For example, if there was a job for a person to map out, you know, protein folding, now Alpha is going to do that. So like DeepMind will do some of the things. So I don't think that that was a job of a person anyways, you know, but I'm just saying like there are going to be a lot of hits to the coding industry, right? There are a lot of people who were just coding. And if you were a person who was coding and making other decisions and doing other creative aspects of it, then you will still have a job. But if you were just coding, there will be a hit to the sort of less creative, but information analysis, like intensive kind of jobs. And I, on my end, I see it with, for example, there used to be a high premium on really quality transcribers. I think that in terms of translation, transcription, that's still going to be really essential to have a human doing that work, or at least training the bots and all of that stuff. But like everything we use from Zoom to any kind of recording software provides a transcription that a human can then go and double check, fact check. We've already seen that without AI. We have a lot of jobs that don't exist anymore and that become obsolete just by technology assuming that task. But most of the jobs that are out there do have a creative component. And even when you think of things that don't seem like a creative thing, like for example, if you're just employed in a factory, and we've had robots doing a lot of factory work as well for a very long time. And we still have humans who need to basically be a part of that process and make sure that the robots are working and make sure that, you know, anything that's like fine-tuned is being fine-tuned by a human being. So we really can harness the knowledge about our brains and about human intelligence to do this right, to do it in a way that it actually helps us to do that fundamental, basic thing that we want to do, which is improve our way of living.
Rena, every podcast we close with a question, and I'm going to ask it in sort of two ways. The question is, are we there yet? The addendum to that is, in what ways are we there and in what ways are we not there yet?
Okay, so I'm going to take this as a, are we there yet in the sense of, is AI really a part of our everyday life? And for me personally, we are there because it is a part of my everyday life. And are we there yet in the way that I want us to be there, where we have defined the difference between human intelligence and artificial intelligence? We're not there yet, because that's something that I am talking to you and your audience about and to other audiences every time I get the chance, but I still feel there's a lack of dialogue around that. So I would like to see us move a little bit further from where we are, where AI is infusing our everyday lives, to the place where we are responsibly using it and we understand how to use it to help empower us to be more creative.
Thank you, Rena. This is great. We appreciate your insights and your time today.
Thank you.
What an interesting conversation, Jamie.
I have thousands more questions for her.
Oh, yes, me too. But what stayed with me is when she spoke about intelligence and how we translate from human intelligence into what it means for artificial intelligence. But more than anything, Rena's way to define intelligence is very appealing, considering that it includes not only how we learn, what we learn, how we apply that knowledge, but also the aspect of creativity that makes a difference for us when we think of artificial intelligence.
Mm-hmm. And the emotional aspect of intelligence as critical to its existence was very eye-opening for me. It sort of seems like she mentioned coders' jobs going away. And a lot of people trained to be coders because they thought that was the future, but all of a sudden, out they go. And so yet the things that will become or already are more important are human interactions. So maybe humans and humans should sort of work more together, and then we let the bots do the things that computers need them to do. So we can kind of be our who we actually are in our true selves that way.
I think the jury is still out when it comes to how artificial intelligence will change this world. And I'm so excited about our next guests, what they have to say to this topic.
Absolutely. See you soon.